show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
High fly ball. Motley going back to the track. No outs to go. The Royals have won the 1985 World Series.
Bouncing ball, Moustakas, fair ball. Sets, throws, Royals win it. Kansas City, you've got a World Series.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
And welcome into the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn. I, of course, am your long lost but hopefully not forgotten host, Jeff Herr. It's been a while since I've been here, but thankfully the unsinkable Michael Engel has been staying the course, keeping the show going for me while I have been busy at work and life and other things. And we're going to do a short little show because I actually have to go pack for my honeymoon tomorrow. But we are going to get stuff in here. We are going to talk about a few things and, you know, let you know that I am still alive. So, like I said, I think it's been like a month. So how you been, Mike?
I've been busy, too. I mean, this last month, we just as many people may know, I work in a college textbook store, and classes started not long ago. So that took up a lot of my time. So it's just been busy preparing for that. And then when the students actually came back. So we've been a little sporadic in our recording. But as we get closer to spring training and everything, the hope is that, you know, we're going to be able to get back on track on a kind of weekly thing. Thankfully, the triple play guys have really been kind of carrying our asses.
They've been carrying the team here.
They've been doing a great job over there. And I think Ben and Audra are going to relaunch Walk Off Talk as a lot of Audra's wedding planning is out of the way. And Ben is kind of getting settled back in to get things going there. So, you know, it won't just be us. It won't just be the three guys at Triple Play. It'll be, you know, three different shows for people to listen to on the network. So that's pretty cool. And yes, it's coming at the right time of year as well, as we're just, you know, just a couple weeks from pitchers and catchers.
Super Bowl's over, so you know what that means. The countdown begins.
It's true.
In case you hadn't been on Twitter for the last 24 hours, many people will remind you when pitchers and catchers are reporting. but since we're going to keep it a little short, we did want to talk about something. There's some developments happening with the Royals in terms of arbitration and different things, and we'll kind of touch on that a little bit later. But most of that is going to work itself out in the next couple of weeks. So in the future shows, we'll have more to talk about because we'll have more concrete numbers and things to work with. But as of right now, some interesting stuff has happened within the last couple of weeks. As we know, or as most will probably know, longtime MLB commissioner Bud Selig has stepped down into retirement, and his replacement, Rob Manfred, has taken over officially now, and he has kind of talked about some different changes that nothing that he's necessarily proposing right now, or that he is, you know, that's his platform or anything like that, but things that he has said that he will listen to, more or less. And one that I really like, we'll talk about this one first. There's a pitch clock that they've talked about, similar to a shot clock in basketball, or a play clock in football, that limits the amount of time a pitcher has in between pitches. Now, I don't know the full details. Like, for instance, pickoff moves. Like, are you only allowed a certain amount of pickoff moves? I don't think that is something that is that you should limit that, because that gives an advantage to the runner knowing, okay, he's tried pickoff three times and he can't do it again, so now I can lead off as long as I want. But then do you reset the shot clock? I don't know. Mike, do you know more about that stuff? I haven't researched it a ton, but
I haven't really seen a whole lot on, you know, the specifics of how they've used the new rule, because they tested it in some of the
Arizona
minor
Fall League, right? Did they do it in Arizona Fall League? Yeah.
Yeah, it was in the AFL, and they're going to do it in some minor league places too. I don't know. I don't know if there's any kind of stipulation on that. It would seem like you would have to set it up so that, you know, if they do step off, they disengage, that resets it. But you know, if you're a pitcher who's really actually trying to just stall and not pitch to a guy, you know, you just step off, throw over when you want to reset. That, you know, I think that's something that within reason the umpire could maybe make a ruling on right then in the context of the game. So I don't know. I'm not entirely sure on how they plan to handle that. I don't think they'd ever restrict the number of pickoff moves because, like you said, it does create kind of an artificial element to you know that whole game, and sometimes that's you know just kind of what you get with baseball. That's part of the game is the cat and mouse of throwing over all the time. I mean, you saw it like in the ALCS last year when the Orioles made a really concerted effort to limit the Royals' running game by varying the timing on their throws over, varying the plays on throws over, just to try to hold the runner just that extra half second so that they couldn't get a bigger lead or get a running lead or get a jump to steal a base. So I think you would have to have some kind of freedom to continue to operate the same way you have, just with a clock to deliver the pitch to the plate.
Yeah, and you know it. I mean, I can see the arguments against it. You know, because the what you will constantly hear and what is constantly correct is that what makes baseball so unique and so incredible, especially in moments like when the Royals have this miraculous come from behind wild card game victory, is it's not bound by a clock at all. In any way, shape, or form. So you are, you know, this is introducing a time element into it. But, I mean, at the end of the day, it's a product. And the product that is on the field right now takes longer than many people think it should. And in our society with so many distractions now, you know, I'm starting to sound old, but it's true. I mean, there's so much technology, so many things going on. Attention span is much shorter, and people's idea of how much time they want to invest in certain things has shifted, you know. And I heard this on the radio. I think it might have been Bob Fesco or something, but you know, just to draw an analogy, you know, you don't get up and you know go to church or go do whatever and get in your fedora and your nice suit and then go to the ballpark for 4 hours for 6 hours for a doubleheader and just kind of that's your day. People don't do that anymore. You know, whether they should or not is a different question, but it doesn't happen. So you know, people want convenience, they want speed, they want to get their enjoyment out of something and be able to move on quickly and do other things. There's nothing wrong with that, but you know, baseball is very traditionalist in nature and needs to grow and evolve to accompany it. And one thing I'll bring up an example, cricket. Most people don't follow cricket, and you know, understandable. Nope. It's not big in America at all, but cricket is a fascinating sport. It's awesome. People should definitely look it up because it's fun to watch. But the difference is the original form of cricket, right, takes like 3 to 5 days to complete one match because they're called wickets, but it's outs just like baseball, you know. But it's so much easier to hit in cricket that you can go just long periods of time without actually getting an out. And so, but they keep going until you get them all. And that's part of the deal. but they were, you know, the game has evolved over the last 200 years, or the public has evolved. And so they switched it and they created this ODI method of cricket where they limited the amount of opportunities you have. So you have a certain amount of pitches, basically, that you can do or that you're – it's hard to explain, but there's like a set of pitches. They call it over. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they like there's 6 pitches to every over and you're limited to a certain amount of overs that you can have. And that shortened the game to like 7 hours. And then but it was just at least contained within a day. Yeah. But then, you know, even that has evolved even more. And they have this thing called 20-20 cricket, which limits you to 20 overs, which is much less than the ODI, which was 50. And that fits into your normal 3 to 4 hour sports venue window, right? And so once that was created, just, you know, within the last decade or so, I'm not sure exactly when it was created, but, you know, it's exploded and it's become the most popular form of cricket because that's what the public has wanted. So that was kind of a long way of saying that baseball needs to look at these things and they need to, and this isn't just some radical thing that, like, oh, you know, some sports radio guy somewhere has come up with his 10 ways to improve baseball that's going to be a Bleacher Report slideshow or something. Like, no, it, you know, this is a legitimate thing, and obviously it's legitimate because the commissioner of baseball now has talking about it, but, you know, and is talking about implementing it, at least in terms of the shot clock or the pitch clock. But it, you know, it needs to be something that's taken seriously, and that needs to be something that, you know, I haven't heard a ton of backlash for it yet, but they will come if it gets more traction. And I think people kind of just need to get over it because you can't have it both ways. You can't have a product that you want to be done quick, you know, a game that you want to be done quickly without having some sort of limitation on the reason that it doesn't get done so quick.
Yeah. I mean, it's a business at the same time. So, I mean, they're fighting for TV dollars. They're fighting for viewers. And if you've got a guy throwing over all the time, if you've got a guy like Clay Buchholz takes like 30 some seconds to throw a pitch. I mean, they put a clock on him during games and it's like, you know, he'll throw a pitch and he'll, you know, walk around the mound and he'll do this and that. And then sets, takes his sign, shakes off, takes forever. And when you do that 100 times, yeah, I can see how you would want to limit somebody from doing something like that, where they're just delaying and delaying. And you know, part of that is his own rhythm, but some of it is because he's been allowed to do it. And it's something that they've never really enforced. It is a rule that you're supposed to deliver within a reasonable amount of time, but nobody's ever really enforced it. And now with a clock...
Yeah, there's technically a rule on how long you can take at a free throw in basketball, but nobody ever forces that either. Same kind.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen it a couple times, but that's in like a lifetime.
Yeah.
Where, okay, they actually got to that point and they're like, all right, we're going to call them. But with the pitch clock, my one concern, like I get the idea. I think that games can speed up, and especially with baseball, like you know, you look at baseball, basketball, football, they all, a game takes about the same amount of time. You know, with football, at least, you know, you run a play, you can show replays of the play while they're in the huddle, then they line up, motion, they run the next play. There's kind of constant movement there. Basketball is always moving for the most part until the last like minute and a half of a college basketball
game. That takes a half hour.
Which takes forever, which that's a whole other thing. But baseball, it's always got that same kind of leisurely pace, and that's why I think a lot of people find it boring. Whereas for me, like, that in between is kind of, you know, where you think about what's coming the next pitch, you build up some of the anticipation, but it does take some time. But my concern would be, like, competitively, how a clock would work with base runners, catchers. Like, where's the clock? Who knows where it is? You know, is just the umpire aware of it? Is just the pitcher? Because I would be concerned if I've got a runner who knows that at 19 seconds that pitcher's got to deliver something. And at that stage, okay, now I know he's going. Whereas before, you can just hold it and hold it and hold it and hold it. And the idea is to get that runner to stop focusing and get flat-footed so that he can't get the same jump and maybe – even if the sign's on or if he has a green light, maybe he doesn't go because you held him there. If he knows that you're about to deliver, well, that's, you know, that's something that you can time. I guess it's kind of like being ready to rush at the end of the play clock in football, which generally isn't too big of an issue, but it's still kind of like, you know, when a guy in football makes a quick snap, you know, it does catch guys off guard, and it's a competitive thing. It's a strategic advantage that you can take, that you can do, you know, because they don't know when you're going to go. When it counts down, then you kind of know. Now, we've talked about this before, and your counter to that was something to the effect of, like, they both know when that's coming. The pitcher can still throw over, and so maybe that runner takes off, which that makes sense to me, but it's still one of those things that it's like, it's artificial to the rest of the game. And it's almost like forcing the action that otherwise wouldn't have been, if that makes sense. But I think in general, it's at least an idea to shave some time off. I also would like to see them enforce keeping the batter in the box, because that's another element where, you know, the batter takes a pitch and goes and wanders around and adjusts the batting gloves for it. They took a pitch. They didn't even swing at the ball. They have to adjust their batting gloves and their helmet and everything else. It's just like, you know, that takes up so much time too. You know,
yeah, there should be, sorry to interrupt, but I think there should be, you know, a batter clock too. They should have like 5 seconds or something.
Yeah.
You know, where as soon as the pitch hits the catcher's glove and the clock resets, whatever it resets at, by a certain time, the batter has to be in the box ready to go. And then the pitcher has the remaining time to throw his pitch.
Yeah. I mean, that would make some sense too, because then, you know, it all adds up eventually, but that's another element that they really need to look at. It's an example. I don't know. I haven't really timed this, but there's an at bat out there, and I think you can find it on YouTube. This is a couple years ago, where Joey Votto was up against Derek Lowe, and Derek Lowe is a pretty fast working pitcher himself, but for some reason, gamesmanship or something, Joey Votto went to the plate, took the first pitch, never left his stance, stayed in his stance, stayed in the box, which is so just unusual that it was almost like he was psyching out Derek Lowe, who ended up in his usual fast way, he, you know, delivered to the plate, threw another ball, 2-0, gets to 3-0. And at that point, Lowe was clearly rattled because it wasn't the normal rhythm that he was used to. And so it threw him off, even though, you know, he's a fast pitcher. But it's like this at bat, it's a four-pitch walk, but it's one of the faster plate appearances you'll see, just because, you know, there's nobody moving around. And yeah. I think that's kind of what they would be looking for, is just really quick plate appearances. You know, give guys time to, you know, get their signs, because, I mean, the context of the count will change what kind of play a team might put on. You know, you're going to run at different counts. You're going to hit and run on different counts. You might bunt and pull off the bunt at, you know, a two strike count. So, I mean, you can't just say you have to be anchored in the box, but, you know, there is an element of, you know, keeping those guys from spending 15 seconds standing around. And then you got to wait 25 seconds for the pitcher to deliver just to get to 0-1. It's just like, you know, you've got to kind of pick some of that up. And that's the goal, really.
And if they really wanted to go further, you could actually put a number on the amount of timeouts that they're allowed, you know, because limitless timeouts is great. But, like, you know, how many times do you have, you know, shakes off a signal, you know, the pitcher and the batter do their rigmarole and they get down, but then the pitcher shakes off signal, shakes it off. And then they call timeout and the catcher comes out and, you know, and then they got to reset. The batter's got to do his thing again. The pitcher's got to do his thing again. And, and then they got to, you know, agree on a sign and everything. Well, you know, if that's the case and you limit that, then it's going to kind of, again, excuse me, force the hand a little bit. And I do agree to a certain extent that, you know, you might be allowing a suboptimal play to happen at the expense of putting a faster product on the field, because a pitcher knows he can't burn a timeout, or he's getting close to the pitch clock, needs to throw a pitch, doesn't feel comfortable, doesn't feel right, like the Derek Lowe situation you were just talking about. And then you get, you know, I mean, the last thing they want to see, I think, is a ton of walks that mm-hmm. go. What they want to see more hitting is what they want to see.
Right.
So there is an interesting flip side and kind of conundrum to it. I mean, I personally think it's a good idea, and I think that it's something that it definitely needs to have some refinement. You know, there's a lot of factors in play that need to be considered.
Yeah, I want to see it in action a little more before, like, I'm not opposed to it, but I can't say I'm in favor completely, just because I want to see how it impacts some of those other things before I really get into it.
But I also think, too, because it doesn't happen a ton, but you see it, you know, a decent amount. Jeremy Guthrie in particular does this every once in a while. You know, you'll have a pitcher do a quick pitch, right?
Yeah.
Where, you know, the batter and the pitcher settle into a kind of rhythm of doing each of their things, and then the pitcher will break that. It's kind of like the reverse of the Joey Votto situation. And basically, you know, and I remember Jeremy Guthrie did it in the playoffs and kind of got some bad looks from people because it's against the unwritten code of baseball and we can't do this because blah, 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 you know, whatever. So
too bad.
Yeah. But I think this will kind of, on the other end of the spectrum, it would kind of normalize that a little bit because with a pitch clock, you know, that's going to be in the back of the hitter's head. The backer, the hitter's going to have to stay ready more of that, you know, of the entire time he's at the plate ready to hit. He's going to have to be more mentally prepared to hit than he was before because he could kind of step out, blah, blah, blah. But if you have a clock on it, then, you know, you're kind of eliminating that quick pitch thing almost because it almost forces both sides to say, okay, you've got to be ready to go at any moment so that since there's a clock now. So I think that could be an added benefit as well. You're going to have, you know, you could have, I should say, players that are a little bit more tuned in, both pitcher and hitter in those scenarios. So, I mean, that's something to think about as well.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I mean, they both got to be ready and it's something that both sides would have to adjust to.
Yeah.
You know, in the end, it's, you know, like I said, they're a business. They want to enhance their product, make it more marketable, get more of an audience. They also want to bring in more offense, which is one of the other things that Manfred kind of brought up is, you know, ways to get more offense. And his first kind of big announcement as commissioner kind of got some blowback immediately because he was talking about defensive shifts and their way of kind of hindering offense. And, you know, as you've seen year by year, offense has gone down and pitching and defense have become more of a factor in the game. And a lot of teams anymore are using, you know, those extreme shifts. The Astros used it a lot. I think the Rays used quite a few of different shifts. And so, you know, that's one of the things as the book comes out on hitters, you know, they're putting fielders in a spot to take advantage of those tendencies. And, you know, in the end, it ends up making, you know, some of the dead pull hitters, whereas that might be a single into right field. Now it's a second baseman playing in shallow right, and he can throw a guy out. So that's something that Manfred kind of hinted at as a goal of eliminating those, which most everybody was against, I think, for the most part. But I guess not everybody was against them. But I know that my initial reaction was, that's crazy. yours was.
Yeah, you know, the pitch clock, talking about an idea I love, this was an idea I hate. And it's because, to me, I look at it, you know, that for the longest time, zone defenses were illegal in the NBA because they felt it hindered offense and they wanted to have an offensive league. And then things got out of hand and the product wasn't what they wanted because, you know, teams not only could they not play zone, but they just didn't play defense really. Mm-hmm. And so they changed it and they made it legal. And you know, things kind of improved, but teams mostly don't play zone anyway. But that was just kind of a small example. But
I think they did a similar thing in hockey too.
Yeah, no, you're right. Oh God, I mean they've changed some of those rules in hockey to try and spur offensive. I mean, hell, they made the freaking goal larger.
Yeah,
but what the reason I don't like it is because this isn't, I mean, it's a competitive advantage, but it's not like the Patriots possibly deflating footballs. You know, it's not something that is outside the prescribed rule book, and in my opinion, not something that is outside the context of how the game was meant to be played. I mean, if baseball is traditionalist in nature, then shifts look weird because people don't line up where they're, you know, supposed mm-hmm. to line up, blah, blah, blah. But baseball, I mean, that was like the most convenient lineup. It was never, you know, players are only supposed to have a prescribed zone that they can play in. You know, it was just this way you've got all the field covered and, you know, yeah. you can kind of go at it, you can change it as need be. So to me, it's an advantage based on the right things, you know, based on studying hitters, based on studying tendencies and using all this data and experience that teams have collected to try and make sure they put themselves in the best position to succeed. I see nothing wrong with this. The idea that, oh, it hampers offenses. Well, I mean, yeah, sure. Maybe it does, and it probably does. But at the same time, then you're letting players off the hook for having less skill. You know, you're looking at Mike Moustakas, and the shifts on him are insane because the guy freaking hits into him every damn time.
Yeah.
No, if the dude would learn to lay down a bunt or hit the ball to freaking left field, he wouldn't have that problem, but he doesn't. And so why would you let him off the hook? Why would you reward lesser skill by making a rule to help these people that have a deficiency in their game? You know, when you reach the highest level of anything, people are going to use every advantage at their disposal to weed out the people that don't have the necessary skill set. And that's what this is. You're playing at the highest level in the world, and teams are going to use every advantage at their disposal to weed out the players that don't have the true skill. And the idea that you're just going to come in and say, well, this is illegal now because it's really hampering what we want. And I understand the business side of it, and I understand you want to put a more exciting product on the field, and maybe it's just me being a baseball nerd, but I mean, I think it's just about as exciting as it's ever been. Like I like seeing pitchers duels, but I like seeing defensive games in football as well. I mean, it's just more intense when one play makes a difference. You know, when you're down 6-0 in the third inning, and you're not even worried about it because you know it's really easy now to score 8 runs, you know, then that's awesome. You know, I was going to say awesome, but it's not, to me, that's not as exciting as, okay, you've got Clayton Kershaw going up against Mike Trout and it's 1-0 Dodgers in the bottom of the 9th inning, you know, and there's a man on. You know, what's going to happen? That one play could shift in the bottom of the 9th, obviously, but, you know, one play could shift the entire complexion of the game that way, as opposed to, you know, just an up or a down in a game that, I don't know. I mean, my point's not really coming across as well, but those games are more enjoyable to me when you're kind of on the edge of your seat, but when in the back of your head, you're like, oh, scoring 3 runs is nothing, you know, like in the steroid era. I mean, when, mm-hmm. you know, your typical game is 7-5 or something like that, you know, it's not as big of a deal to score a run. So the idea of being behind by a run doesn't make you feel that bad. But if you're in that situation where now it's tougher to score, pitchers have such a great advantage, you know, those plays are so important. It's so important to have quality at bats. It's so important to refine your skill because you never know when that one play could happen that's going to change the game. To me, that's more valuable to baseball as a product. But I appear to be in the clear minority because I do think the casual fan probably wants something different.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing with shifts is like there was some information on Fangraphs and the Hardball Times that I tracked down, right? the Fangraphs I found, and they had tracked down information from the Hardball Times to properly attribute the research. But basically that the production on a ball in play hasn't really changed that much over the last 10 years, but the runs per game has still gone down. So the idea of the conclusion is that even taking away the shifts really wouldn't change that much. I mean, if you think about it, if that guy at second base, that second baseman's playing in right field, you know, to get David Ortiz on a ground ball. Well, he took a single away from the guy. And maybe if that happens with a guy on third base with two outs, yeah, that stops one run. But if it's, you know, a guy leading off, you know, that's pretty much just, you know, taking out one out. It's taking away a single. You know, it's not going to stop anybody from hitting a home run. It's not going to stop anybody from going the opposite way and hitting the gap, you know, on a nice solid line drive or something that one hops the wall. You know, it's just taking away those marginal kind of singles that normally would have gotten through without a shift. Now they're being played, and more teams are taking advantage of those dead pull hitters. And it's usually the dead pull hitters that it happens to. It's generally not, you know, if a guy like, you know, you brought up Mike Trout, or a guy like, you know, Billy Butler, or a guy like, you know,
even Cabrera.
Miguel Cabrera, guys in their heyday and the elite hitters, those guys are going to spray the ball all over the place.
They're going to play it straight up.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. There's no shift on those guys because there's no tendency. They're going to take the ball where it is. They're going to hit it hard, and they're going to hit it, you know, into a gap or over the fence. You know, it's just that's what they do because they're excellent hitters. And what you've seen over the years is that walks are down and strikeouts are up because guys can't make contact, or they're just getting out scouted and they're not making adjustments. And so that's what it is. It's always a constant game of adjustment. And the teams, the guys that get shifted aren't making adjustments either to figure out how to take that ball the other way instead of rolling it over to second, or they're just not even trying. You know, they're just going to still pull and pull and pull and pull. And that's all they're going to do. So a guy like Moustakas, who is dead pull, you know, isn't working on going the other way. So they're going to continue to shift up. So why wouldn't they? I mean, it's a slippery slope to put it this way. But, you know, what would change from, hey, pitchers, you can't throw on the hands anymore because guys can't hit a ball on their hands that well. You know, why is that any different? I mean, a pitcher is going to look at the scouting report and say, this guy doesn't hit the ball well in this spot, I'm going to try to throw to that spot. It's like saying you can't throw a slider down and away to Sal Perez anymore because he's not going to hit it.
And
it's just like, I mean, you don't need to do that. The game evolved with, you know, like you said, the players position themselves, you know, like old games like town ball and rounders and things like that. Man, they didn't have positions. They just went where they thought the ball was going to get hit. And over time, you figured out that this guy usually hits it here, so you played more guys around there, and that's how it developed in the regular game. So that, you know, most of the time you put your best fielder at shortstop because most of your ground balls get hit to shortstop. That's just how it works out, and that's what you do. That's the game. You adjust to it. You get your scouts out there. You use, like you said, analysis and experience, and you set your defense that way. It's not any different than any other game where you kind of hedge towards what the tendency is going to be.
And then you look to go along with your kind of slippery slope argument. I mean, then what happens if you start to limit, well, you know, not only can you not shift left to right, but now you can't shift forward to back too, right? Because so Jerod Dyson's up there, and he can lay down a bunt, and it's basically a free hit. The guy's going to hit 400 because he bunts all the time because you're not allowed to play up on the grass
all the time.
You know, I mean, you have to take that next logical step if you're going to take this first step and eliminate shifts, because then it's like, well, how is moving up to play a bunt any different than moving to play a pole? You know, it's based on a tendency and what you think's going to happen. And then you look just the sheer logistics of it. Okay, so how do you define a shift, right? Then you're basically, baseball is going to have to put in the rule book a diagram of a baseball diamond broken up into zones, and they're going to have to say, this is the third baseman's zone.
This is legal.
He is only allowed to line up here. Shortstop, second base, first base here, whatever. Then what about the outfielders? You know, same deal. Where are their zones? How do you line those up? And then, you know, how do you legislate that? Do you actually have to draw the lines on the field? You know, then players are going to start to game the system. They're going to go as far as they can to this arbitrary line as they possibly can.
Or could you sprint from one spot to sprint mid-pitch to get
soon
to
your
spot?
Exactly. As soon as the pitcher starts his roll, could you just run over to the shift, you know?
Yeah, they're going to they'll find their ways to work the system. It's kind of like when the catch review last year, early in the year, was kind of going down. And technically in the rules, there would be ways to, like, kick the ball around, like, until you transfer it to your hand or something like that, it's not officially a catch. So you could, like, if you've got a runner on first and one out and you catch the ball in your glove, you could run to second, drop it there, grab it, step on second, and go to first. That's extreme, but I think theoretically it would have been within the rules to do that and have it ruled that way. Now, they changed it because the spirit of the rule isn't to allow for that, and it's crazy. So, but players would find whatever advantage, if they were able to do it, they would find a way to do it, to skirt the rule. And I don't think that it would even matter. I guess the only way they could really enforce it is you can't have more than two infielders on one side of the base, but then you just line your guy up right by second and go.
I mean, half the time, you're not even looking at someone like Mike Moustakas, the example that we brought up, just because he's a Royal, you know. I mean, he's going to have one of the more extreme shifts. But if you're most shifts, the shortstop is not going to go past second base anyway, you know. And I would guess if you're going to have some sort of arbitrary line, it's going to be drawn right through the middle of second base. And then – but the more important part really is because, like, when Moose got caught – hitting into the shift in the playoffs a lot, it was the second baseman that was way out in shallow right field that was getting the out, that was fielding the play. So that comes back to, you know, if you're going to limit it side to side, you have to limit it front to back, because most of the time the second baseman wasn't really that far out of what would probably be the second baseman's quote unquote zone.
He was, you know, just 30 feet
really far back. So that's part of that shift. You'd have to do that. You know, you'd have to say, okay, not only can you not go within 10 feet of first base, but you can only go 10 feet into the grass as well. And then you can't just do it for second base. You've got to do it for both sides of the field. And you're painting too much into a corner. You're telling teams, because I mean, for me, rules are there to make sure that, you know, there's a good product, to keep some integrity in the game, not necessarily to tell teams how to play, if that makes sense. You know, you're making sure that things stay in the confines of how the game was meant to be played, but you're not necessarily telling them to play a certain way. This is dictating to every team in baseball how to play. And I don't like that. Do whatever you want to do and put the onus on the other team to beat you at what you're going to do. You know, I mean, every other sport is like that, where they go out there. I mean, if you're in football, right, they crowd the line of scrimmage, they're going to blitz. You know they're going to blitz. But guess what? You're Peyton Manning back there. He's going to beat you because that's what he does. Aaron Rodgers is going to beat you because that's what he does. Those guys are the skilled players. But, you know, Alex Smith may not beat you because he's not that skilled. So that's not on the defense. That's not the defense's fault that Alex Smith can't make a play. You know, I'm not picking on Alex Smith, just as, you know, somebody that's not as skilled as a Aaron Rodgers or something. But it's the same kind of deal. You know, it's not on the San Francisco Giants. It's not on them to make sure that Mike Moustakas can hit a single in the World Series. You know, it's on Mike Moustakas. So if they want to shift, then he needs to be the one that makes them pay for it. And that should be like the simplest thing in sports. You beat the other team with whatever they're doing. And this just completely eliminates a competitive aspect of the game, if you ask me.
There's always a way to counter some of those things. If it's a zone in basketball, you know, there's always either go on the wings or go baseline or get the ball in the middle.
Shoot over the top, skip passes.
Do any of that. Yeah, you can find that. If team's playing zone all the time, well, settle your guys into the zone. You know, if a team's playing on the line in football, you know, throw on them. If they're playing back, yeah, I mean, it's just there are counters to it, and it's the same in baseball. It's, you know, if you've got a strikeout pitcher, we'll put high contact guys in there. If you've got a guy who doesn't walk a lot of guys, well, okay. If he's going to throw strikes, put in your guys who are really good at hitting strikes all the time. It's, you know, make your adjustments in game, in the at bat, in, you know, whatever series, and just go with it. That's what it's always been. So, the shift thing doesn't make sense. If a team is willing to be ingenious in making those scouting decisions and trying that, then let them do it. Plus, the other thing is, like, it's there's not that much evidence that it would help that much.
No, and
so why do it?
Yeah, because what's really funny to me is just kind of as we've been saying this whole time, like, we're saying put the onus on the hitter to hit it to the other side, but the defense is making themselves vulnerable as well as trying to get an advantage, you know? So they're taking a risk. So it's not as though this is some uncontrollable advantage that automatically makes it so hitters can't hit, you know? It's not like doctoring a baseball that's completely outside the context of what should be happening. You know, it's not like corking your bat or something where it's going to give an unnatural effect on the game. You know, this is – it's not like they put an extra guy on the field. Just shift everybody.
Yeah.
And then they put themselves in a position to get burned. They just don't because hitters don't have the skill. So I don't know. I mean, that's kind of the – basis of our thoughts on it. I'm starting to just repeat myself now, but
yeah.
I mean, it's,
I don't
agree with it.
I don't think it's that close to happening either. I think that it was one of the first things he said to anybody, really put a lot, you know, that primacy effect, you know, made it seem like that's a very important thing. And he kind of walked it back since. And I think that's sensible. Also, it's hard to enforce it. Negligible impact on actually increasing offense. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think it's anything to worry about. It's also kind of weird to think that they're worried about speeding up the game, but they also want to increase offense. It's tough.
Yeah,
it doesn't seem like
ideas.
It seems like that doesn't really work, but I guess.
I think he even mentioned, too, possibly lowering the mound as well. Which is the same thing that happened
after
'60s, after the year of the pitcher, yeah. And people were calling last year the year of the pitcher too, basically. So, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily be opposed to that idea, whatever. But I'd have to see some more data on how much of a difference it makes. But yeah, there's all these conflicting, and it's probably more of kind of like what you're saying, just kind of a popcorn idea thing of, hey, you know, this is one way to change the game and improve things. This is one way to change it and improve things. They don't necessarily have to be all, you know, congruent where they would all work together. Mm-hmm. You would just pick the, so I definitely understand just kind of throwing a lot of things out there, and you're right. He has walked it back a little bit, but if that's an idea that's the one that people have latched onto most, I think just because people like myself and us are most passionate about, because it doesn't seem to make much sense. But
yeah,
seems
out of the spirit of the game.
Yeah. So from there, those were kind of the major things we wanted to touch on. We do have a little bit of Royals news to talk about. So, Mike, there is, you know, with all the free agency and everything else that gone on, there's still a couple big fish out there, one of which was in the World Series pitching last year, named James Shields.
Pretty big fish.
James Shields. And he hasn't signed and hasn't really had much traction. You have not. At the beginning, it was like, okay, I don't really expect to hear James Shields' name a ton, because you got Max Scherzer out there. You had, you know, all these other pitchers that are going to sign for a lot more money and that are younger and more talented, quite frankly, even though that's not a slight to James Shields at all.
Mm-hmm.
But so... And to me, it kind of felt like, as a 32-year-old, James Shields was in a position where he wanted that big contract, wanted that big money. And I thought many teams were in the, we don't want to pay you $20 million, James Shields, but we will if we have to. So they were going to kind of wait. Once the big names got signed, whatever, then some team would jump in and say, all right, James Shields, you're the best that's left. You're worth the $20 million to us right now, even though you weren't a month ago. So let's make this happen. You know, that's kind of what I thought would happen, because that's baseball. You know, when the way it's gone now with salaries going out of control, players are worth what a team will pay, and what that is dictated by what's out there, what the team needs, so forth. But he hasn't signed anywhere yet and still doesn't have much traction. There have been a couple rumors of him having some possible $20 million-plus deals that he either didn't want or wanted to hold out for more or what, but it seems most teams are wanting that more along the 3 to 4 year range, and he wants more of the 5+ possibly. So, but he's still out there.
Yeah.
And now the pendulum has kind of swung back around to, hey, wait a second. Can the Royals actually make this work? Could they possibly bring back James Shields next year? And I believe the quote from Dayton Moore or from somebody in the, I think it was Dayton Moore, was that they're monitoring the right situation, which, you know, of course they would, because they sent him a qualifying offer. But so I don't know, Mike. I mean, this is kind of interesting. I mean, what's it going to take to keep James Shields in the blue and white next year?
Well, I think he went into the offseason thinking he was going to get something in the 5-year, $100 million kind of range, and probably reasonable to expect that considering how salaries have been and what his track record is with Tampa and with Kansas City. I think most considered him to be the third guy in the free agent tree, I guess, behind John Lester and Max Scherzer. And I think most everybody expected that once Lester or Scherzer signed somewhere, the other two would go quickly, because you know you're a team looking for a frontline guy. Those are basically your three frontline guys. If there's one fewer guy out there, well, then that makes the other two that much more of a commodity. But it didn't really work out that way. Lester signed, and Scherzer just kind of hung out there, and then Scherzer signed, and Shields has just kind of been waiting. And there is a certain point where it pivoted, where teams now in February, I mean, it's February 3rd, a lot of them have filled what holes they can fill with guys that they saw as alternatives. The Royals, for instance, went with Edinson Volquez, who, you know, when they felt like they couldn't reach James Shields' price tag, they went with Volquez. And now they essentially have their rotation filled. They have a full bullpen, and they have some guys in the minors. And so I don't think they expected it to get to this point. It's kind of like last year with Santana, where you hit a point where it's like, wait, you know, the Royals, could they go get him back again? And I think it feels about the same way, where it's like, maybe they could. The issue that I would see is the actual money involved. And even though it's Shields, and even though his leverage is kind of down, I think he still can expect maybe 4 years. Buster only had something on ESPN, I think it was yesterday, or the day before maybe, about where Shields might end up. And some rival executives are saying, like, if he can get a 3-year deal from someone with good money, he needs to be taking it. And so if that's the thing, you know, there might be a team out there who's willing to go with that fourth year to make sure it gets done. So, you know, what that means, average annual value, I don't know. 16, 17, 18 million probably seems about fair for a guy like him. So if you're looking at 3 years, 48, 50 million, I think that's reasonable for him and for any team that wants to sign him. But for a team like the Royals, they have to find a way to fit that money into their budget. I mean, they're already at like $90 million. They still have 4 arbitration cases out there. So I don't know what they would do. Plus, you've got the idea of you've got Yordan Ventura, who's not going to the minors. He's not going to the bullpen. You've got Guthrie, who can't go to the minors. Would probably be difficult to trade, considering he's making $9 million, has a $3 million option, and frankly isn't that good outside of Kauffman. You got Vargas, who's relatively cheap, underwhelming, but you know, good enough. And Volquez, who you can't trade until June 15th on his deal, just because of when he signed as a free agent. And then that would leave like Duffy, you know, who was a really good starter last year. So the Royals would have a really difficult decision there on, could they move Guthrie? Would they put Duffy in the bullpen? But I still think that if the opportunity is there, they need to do it, because James Shields immediately would make any pitching rotation better, except for like Washington's,
Yeah, or maybe he, Dodgers or something.
Yeah, but I mean, he'd still be, if he was their fifth guy on either of those teams,
yeah,
that's pretty good. Yeah,
and I think with the Central being more or less out there for the taking, Max Scherzer, we just talked about being gone with the Nationals, not in the Central anymore. Mm-hmm. Don't have to worry about him. Tigers still have David Price, but Justin Verlander is not what he once was. So it's basically only David Price is what they've got. And then the rest are just, you know, some decent pitchers now. So, you know, all the other teams have made moves, and the Central's pretty muddled right now in the sense that everybody's pretty close. I think the White Sox and the Indians are going to take a big step up next year, and it's open. It's there for the taking. And if you're the Royals and you can go out and get James Shields, I think that immediately puts you in the driver's seat and you are no longer a contender. Right now, they're a contender for the Central. But if you were to bring back James Shields, it would automatically make you the favorite for the center. Absolutely. Yeah. For the Central. absolutely. And, like, I mean, when was the last time they were really the favorite? 2004, maybe? And that doesn't really count. That was people ignoring what they saw and just going off of what they were kind of hoping, I guess. I don't know.
Like 1990?
Maybe.
That's about it. I mean,
it's been a long time. And I mean, it says something that, you know, the Royals aren't even the favorites right now. Well, I mean, they'll get a decent amount of picks, I think, to win the Central, but they're not the favorites right now. And they went to the World Series. They represented the American League. So that kind of just shows you how tough it is. And if they were to bring back James Shields, that would be them. They'd be in the driver's seat. And then you'd have people not only talking about can they contend for the Central, they'd say they're the favorites for the Central. Can they contend to get back to the World Series for a second year and win it? I mean, you'd have to make that argument again, because they'd still have the best bullpen in the league. They'd have an even better rotation. I mean, you'd have James Shields as your number one again, plus mm-hmm. Duffy and Ventura coming back. Ventura would probably be pushing Shields for the number one.
Yep.
And then you throw Vargas and Volquez in there. You'd probably have to bump Guthrie, make him your long man, and still have a crazy good set of relievers, same defense you had last year. And, you know, maybe you get some improvements on offense, and then this team is, you know, you're looking 90 plus wins probably.
Yeah.
is I think a realistic expectation. Now this is kind of a pipe dream here, but it's something that, like you said, just similar to the Santana situation, it has a little bit more reality to it than previous. And there were rumors that the Royals had kind of mulled around offering maybe like a 4-year, $80 million deal or something like that. I think it was. I can't remember what exactly the figures were, but something that was, you know, a little bit less money, a little bit shorter time frame. And Shields is looking definitely for longer. I don't know if that was actually something they ever offered. Maybe it was just something like, I don't know what, but, point being, you know, if you offered something like that, and we were kind of talking about this back and forth in the emails today with David Leske, you know, if you were to throw a 3-year, you know, $55-60 million contract at him and give, you know, you could play around with the numbers some, that it wouldn't kill you a bunch this year, but it would still give him a ton of guaranteed money. Then maybe you tack on an option year, which the Royals are going to do anyway, because they always do it with everyone ever. So, I mean, it's something that if they got creative with it and they really wanted to do it, and, you know, it would take Dayton Moore basically hat in hand in David Glass's office saying, please give me this, we can make this happen, you know, then I mean, man, that'd be something, wouldn't it?
I think it'd be great. I mean, I think he'd immediately make the Royals better. I think they would be the favorites. You'd be sitting on a team that has already got an elite defense, an elite bullpen, and he would strengthen the rotation so much. You know, a lot of people are really concerned, and I guess probably some teams are concerned about his age, but you know, at the same time, it's not – historically, guys his age usually haven't gotten big deals, but the guys who have gotten deals that are close to his age have usually been really good pitchers, and he's a really good pitcher. So I think he'd be worth something in the realm of a big contract. I think in his mind, he's probably thinking of, he wants to get a spot where he can win. and get back into the World Series. And he wants to make a lot of money because this is probably his last big contract of his career, you know, being 30, you know, going to be 33 when the season's going. So I get why he might not have jumped on any 3 or 4 year offers in December or January. But at this point, he's starting to get to where he does have to kind of look at some of those. So if the Royals can put it together, I think that's a great landing spot for him. I mean, the last 2 years, he was a 4-win pitcher. Wins above replacement, that is, not pitcher wins. For the Royals, he'd be in a stadium that would really cater to him because he's a fly ball pitcher and would have an excellent defense behind him. Plus, familiarity over the last 2 years. You know, the Royals would know more about him over the last 2 years than any other team. Has worked with Dave Island before. So I also think that at this stage, you know, if he jumped in, he'd be going right back in as if, you know, he had never left the Royals. And that would almost be like a continuity that would possibly help him. Now, he's a veteran, so I don't imagine he would, if he signed with Toronto tomorrow, he'd be, you know, all kinds of, you know, awkward thumbs trying to get on the mound and everything, forgetting how to do it. But, you know, I think it would maybe be an element that might sway him if all things are equal. To go back to Kansas City. So, yeah, if they can do it, they should do it. I'm not worried about injuries so much. You know, the more I think about it, you know, any pitcher can get hurt at any time. It's just the nature of the position. It can happen just on one throw. But there's a certain point where you have to kind of give a guy credit for the durability. It's like nobody really talks about Mark Burley as being an injury risk because he's thrown so many innings over his career. But he's in the same boat as Shields, and there's some concern out there about Shields being an injury risk, even though I don't think he's missed a start since 2007 and hasn't really had any issues at all since he's, you know, other than maybe his rookie year when he came into the league. So and into the minors when he had some shoulder surgery. But that was forever ago. It's not something that I think, you know, really is a worry. I think you have to give him credit for being able to take up those innings and those starts. And I think it's almost like one man's durable is one man's due for an injury. And it's just, I don't think that's sound. I mean, I get it. The more you pitch, the more, you know, it's more opportunities for that one pitch that might blow your elbow. But I think it's like anything else. If a guy's not shown a lot of injuries, he's probably not likely to get hurt unless it's something that just kind of would happen with anybody else in any other similar situation. So I'm not concerned about that either. I think over 4 years, I think he'd be a decent investment. I think by the fourth year, he'd probably get to be pretty average, but I think he's a smart enough pitcher and competitive enough that, you know, he could probably find a way to adjust and work around diminishing stuff and maybe endurance and all of that. So I really wouldn't be concerned at all if they went 4 years on him. It wouldn't bother me a bit. Now, I think it could be a concern just because they do have future arbitration cases and things like that. But at the same time, you look at what the Royals have committed past 2017. I think basically, you know, you've got Sal's option and Omar Infante has another year. And that's about it. I mean, that's, you know, arbitration dudes and those guys. And that's about it. You know, Moustakas and Hosmer will be free agents unless they extend Gordon. He'll be gone after 2016, most likely. I think they will extend him as an aside. But, you know, you're looking at basically your windows to 2017 and then hoping that the other guys in the minors can rise up and replace those guys as they're leaving. But, you know, you've got about 3 years with this team as they're constructed. So, yeah, go get James Shields for 3 years. Get him through 2017 and then see where you're at. Why not?
Yeah, you know, it. I mean, it's one of those things I feel like we, once a year, we find ourselves falling into this trap of, you know what, maybe they could actually make this happen. But, it probably won't. But
yeah, I'm thinking 5% likelihood at best. Yeah,
but that's 5% more than we thought a month ago. So, sure. You know, who knows? But regardless, you know, the Royals are still definitely a legitimate contender. But with that said, Mike kind of touched on arbitration, a lot of things figured out. We haven't really the Royals settled with Lorenzo Cain today for $2.75 million, I believe, and Mike Moustakas got like $2.6 million, both on one-year contracts to avoid arbitration. So we're not going to talk a ton about that simply because we're going to wait a little bit because they've got a few weeks to figure everything out and get everybody. So we'll just kind of hit on everything. And it's arbitration. I mean, we all know kind of what the deal is. So it's not something that, you know, there's none of those players that are not going to be here next year or going
right. to
have some weird thing happen with arbitration. So
despite what Facebook might try to tell you.
Yes.
They just, by and large, people just, I mean, people just don't understand it sometimes. And it's not simple, but it's not complicated either.
No.
I think people make it out to be more complicated and don't try to learn the terminology and the details of it.
Yeah.
Now, it makes me glad I'm not an NBA fan because there's all kinds of crap with like contracts and max contracts and like there's like an early bird clause or something. I have no idea what the hell the deal is with the NBA and their transaction rules. And
they've got some weird stuff. You've got contract exemptions that don't actually count towards all, you know, whatever.
I don't get it.
I've spent a lot of time going over football contract stuff and some of that is still beyond me. So, I mean, arbitration is probably the stickiest thing, but other than that, baseball's pretty straightforward. You sign a contract, it's guaranteed.
Yep.
Pretty much it.
There it is.
So with that, I think we'll leave you. Of course, we always say it's going to be a shorter show, ends up being an hour. So,
Maybe an hour is a short show.
That's true. Maybe these days it is. one last thing. As many of you may know, I am a TV junkie, so I want to get your opinion, Mike. We get a lot of good shows coming back and some new ones starting. The Americans just started last week. I'm super pumped about that. If you guys are not watching that show, you need to watch it on FX. The Americans, it's season 3. You got some catching up to do, but it's totally worth it. Plus,
Carrie Russell.
Carrie Russell is a total babe. But anyway, ain't that right, Garth? there's that. And then you've got, okay. Walking Dead comes back this weekend, this Sunday, I believe. Better Call Saul, the spinoff from Breaking Bad starts, I believe, next Monday. And then you have Game of Thrones coming back in April. And you got a lot of stuff, Mike. What lay it on me? What are you looking forward to? I don't know if you watch The Americans or not, but what do you got now that you're tapped out on Black Mirror? What are you looking
for? Yeah. Well, I haven't watched The Americans. I want to. I was hoping it would be on Netflix. I think it's on Amazon.
It's on Prime. I got my wife a Prime membership, and it's on there.
Yeah, I have that, so that might be the next one. I've been rewatching Game of Thrones for the third time now.
Nice.
So, I don't know. I like a show like that that's just super epic. And it makes me curious what the hell my problem was like getting into it in the first place. So I actually bought one of the books. I haven't read the books, but I bought one of the books because I just wanted more background, but I didn't want to like spoil looking too deeply. So so I've got that going.
And it's I'm like 3/4 of the way through the first book, and it is.
Which I mean, is like 600 pages.
Right, exactly. It is. I mean, nearly word for word. Like, and I've heard from many people that have read all the books, not until the fourth one or so does it really start to branch off. Mm-hmm. It's pretty by the book. So there's not much. you're getting a little bit more background, and there's a little bit more, you know, kind of
just detailed stuff they can't necessarily get to,
if you will.
Yeah.
And in terms of, I mean, my goal was actually when I started reading like in the summer, and I was like, okay, if I stick to this schedule, read this many pages a day, then I'll completely be caught up by next season, because I'd heard they're really going to branch off from the book. So I was like, it's not really going to spoil much because I hear they're changing a lot anyway for the next season. But as often does when I read books, it fluttered out. And I'm on like page 450 or something, but I will finish at some point.
Yeah. I mean, I think some of that is just, you have to work with the cast, and if a particular character or performer is really interesting, you kind of have to write them. It's kind of like Omar on the Wire was going to be in like two episodes.
Yeah.
And it was like the best character in the whole series.
Well,
so then, yeah.
And they actually kind of like Breaking Bad, they actually kind of lucked out because Gus, he was supposed to be just an ancillary character, and the quote unquote big bad was supposed to be Tuco. But did you watch Breaking Bad?
Yeah.
Okay, so you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So I was like, I hope you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, but, I watched I went through that twice. So
the actor who played Tuco had a prior commitment. So the amount of time they would have needed him to be in order to be the main villain, he couldn't devote that much time to the show. So they had to shift kind of mid show, if you will, and turn Gus into one of the best villains in TV history.
Hmm.
So yeah, sometimes you kind of have to roll with the punches and shows end up better for it. Sometimes they make mistakes though, and it's not as good. I can't think of one off the top of my head, but I'm sure I could if I tried. But
yeah, I'm also looking forward to The Walking Dead, which has had
it's been their strongest season yet, if you ask me.
Yeah, it has. It's had its duller moments, not this season, but just the past seasons. They've kind of hit their lulls. Season two, like most of it. That was awful. But I kind of like, I don't know. That's another one where it's a weird show in that there's nobody that I particularly like.
Yeah.
I've gone through elements where I just really openly dislike a character or don't see a point in them. But the kind of the premise is so strong and kind of interesting that it's like, okay, I kind of want to stick with this and
see. The world is so fully realized.
Yeah.
That, and maybe part of it is because I've read the comics, so I know. But at the same time, I think just from watching the show, even though it might meander at times, like you feel like there's somewhere to be, like it's going somewhere. And that's kind of why it's frustrating, is because, you know, it's just almost,
you get moving,
almost intentionally delaying getting to that part. Maybe that's why it's so addicting for so many people. But I do kind of agree with what you're saying.
Yeah. So that I'm pretty happy about. Other than that, I mean, I don't know. I guess New Girl, but I think they've been showing new episodes of that lately, and that was one I just kind of in the last month and a half, 2 months, kind of got into and just binged and caught up. That's kind of about it, I think. I mean, there's not a whole lot that I've been trying to track down, and nothing's popping into my head. But like,
yeah.
Game of Thrones, Walking Dead, those are the only two shows that I'll watch when they actually air.
Appointment TV, yeah.
Right. So it's like, yeah, I'm gonna watch those. And then rewatch them. Like Walking Dead, I'll watch it when it airs. I'll watch Talking Dead, and then I'll rewatch the episode.
Yeah. See, it.
So
I'm gonna be pretty busy coming up because they got the Americans in full swing. Which, if not for Mad Men, that's probably. And Mad Men's about to go off the air. So
never watched Mad Men.
Oh man. It might be my favorite show of all time, depending on the day you talk to me. But The Americans is probably the best show on TV now that Mad Men will be going off, in my opinion. So I'll be watching The Americans. I'm definitely tuning into Better Call Saul just to see, you know, what it's like and if it can be. It's going to be a different show than Breaking Bad, so it's hard to say that if it can be as good because it'll just be different. But and then same deal as you, Walking Dead. Game of Thrones, boom, locked in, both of those. And actually, my wife and I just started watching Jane the Virgin, which you might laugh, but that's a damn good show. It's on the CW. Never thought I would ever watch a show on
CW, wow.
But here I am. I heard a bunch about it. Like we both heard a bunch about it, that it was good. Like I follow a lot of TV critics on Twitter raving about it. So we're like, all right, let's give this thing a shot, see what happens. On demand, fire it up. Man, it's really good. It's funny. It's fast paced. I mean, like not like action or anything, but moves along pretty quick, keeps you engaged. it's a good show, you know? So what are you going to do? I like what I like.
a certain point where you just have to say, yeah, screw it. I like that. And
yeah, you know, she won, and the lead actress won the Golden Globe for best actress in a comedy. And
yeah,
but.
Oh, you know what else? Parks and Rec just relaunched too, is another one. I kind of forgot because when I watched the first couple episodes of the new season, I didn't really like what they did. Because they jumped a couple years into the future in it. And so I was like, that's kind of weird.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of like, there's a gap that as it goes along, you have to kind of learn about what happened in the gap. And it's like, I don't like that. I kind of want to just continue what had happened. And also the way the previous season had ended was very much like a series finale. It was very much like, you know, it winks towards the in jokes and sentimentality and blah blah blah, and it's, you know, kind of an epilogue of sorts where you kind of see where everybody ended up. But I'm pretty sure this one's going to get there. The one of the last episodes kind of redeemed some of the issues I was having with it. So I think it's going to be fine to get through. So that's, I'm not really too concerned about disliking the rest of the season.
Right. And I'm late to the party on this one, but I've been watching a ton of Modern Family lately.
Yeah, me too.
On big time syndication. I never watched it. And honestly, I was kind of like, what the hell's the fuss about this show? You know, like, I didn't really like see what was so great about it just from hearing people talk about it and stuff. But I watched it, man. Oh, boy. I just like laugh constantly. And I totally get it now why people love that show. Freaking Phil Dunphy is my spirit animal. That's just the fact. That is, he's the best character in that show. Man, it's so funny. Because like, I'm kind of annoyed by Sofia Vergara, like in general. So I was like, man, why would I watch this show when she's kind of annoying and stuff? And then she totally works in the confines of the show.
Yeah.
And it totally makes sense why she acts the way she does, because she basically tries to play up her character in real life because people like her character, but it's annoying in real life because nobody's actually like that. But
right.
You know, whatever. It works, and it's hilarious.
Yeah,
so, yeah, late to the party, but totally digging that show.
I'd never watched that until, like, November. I just happened to – this is when I was in Salt Lake City for a work thing, and we had some time between doing this and that and whatever. So I went up and watched some Modern Family. It was like I'd never watched it, and it was just amusing. It was just funny. It's one of the – my favorite jokes on it is there's an episode where they go to Australia, and Claire,
which one you're talking about,
the wife, is working with her dad, and they take a laptop to try to seal a deal, and so they keep referring to her laptop as her baby, and so it's at one point there's stuff happening in the foreground, and this dog runs off with the laptop, and she's chasing it. She's like, that wild dog has my laptop, which is a play on a dingo ate your baby. So I thought that was pretty, just like when I made the connection, I was like, oh, okay. All right. And they have a lot of those moments too. And it's like the cast is really well done. It's goofy. But there's, you know, a lot of like, it's kind of like, you take the kind of madcap goofiness of Parks and Rec, and you take the cringy, awkward parts of The Office, and you kind of take the best of both of those series. Not saying it's better than either of those, but I think it's pretty good.
Yeah, and it's got the funny moments too, where like they obviously talk to the camera like it's some sort of documentary or something.
Yeah.
But then also when they're like living their lives, they obviously, kind of the premise is that they're being taped. So whenever there's like an inside joke or they make a funny comment, they'll give kind of the side eye to the camera.
Like you catch
it's
that.
Always, yeah, it's always just perfect timing. Kind of like if you watch House of Cards, damn, which is also coming back in February to Netflix.
I haven't watched that either.
Oh, you should. The old Frank Underwood gives the old side eye to the camera quite a bit, which is funny.
But, well, it was Kevin Spacey. I should watch that.
You should. It's good. It's like Breaking Bad meets West Wing. It's awesome.
Okay. Well, yeah.
So you should give it a shot.
It's an easy sell.
Yeah, there you go. So, but I think with that, we'll wrap it up here. So yeah, we hopefully, you know, as arbitration kind of figures itself out, we got a little bit more. We'll have a little bit more to talk to here in the future. And we're going to try and keep more regular schedule. Things have been kind of hectic in both our lives with being busy at work and such. And Troy stepped in for me a couple weeks ago. But we're going to try and keep this thing rolling and put out a little bit more consistent content. So we apologize for the inconsistency lately. But, you know, life is life.
We owe everybody a prospect show of some sort.
We do. There was
some of the rankings came out.
Rankings out, yes.
And I know that the Zips projections are coming out for the Royals on this Friday, I think, is what Dan Zimborski said. So, and we'll have to reach out and get him on the show. I think we've made overtures towards him to bring him on, and it just has never happened. So I think that's the perfect time. So maybe we'll give him a holler and see if we can make that happen for like next week or something. Been a while since we had a guest on.
It has been a while since we've had a guest.
Yeah. Huh. I don't know.
Yes.
We'll give it a shot.
Yes, we will. So, yeah, with that, we will go ahead and leave you guys until next time. We'll put it that way.
Right. Probably next week, but
probably next week, because I have not. When I get back from my honeymoon on Sunday, and then I have off on Monday and Tuesday from work still, so I have plenty of time and no distractions. So we can probably get 2 weeks in a row with the show here. So yeah, with that, we'll leave you. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for stopping by. Thanks for listening. This has been the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn. For Michael Engel, I am Jeff Herr. Thank you as always for stopping by, and go Royals.
Come to Spit Cup this week. We'll let the person who has the highest bar tab ride the bull. We don't have any TVs in our bar, but we make our own entertainment. Mondays, it's free cover charge to anybody with a gun rack in their pickup truck. Tuesdays, we've got $8 beer night. All domestic beers are on special for only $8. It's Spit Cup. Wednesdays is longest tobacco spit. Thursdays is foot fungus night. Friday night is jamboree night. Bring your crap kick in your 10-gallon hats. And this weekend, you get our world-famous Spit Cup girls. You get to pick which one has the most teeth. It's Spit Cup. No love letters, talking to the wall. Or you could go to Kelly's Westport Inn. The highest quality drinks with the lowest prices. You know what we do. Drinks, friends, plenty of TV showing sports. They've got all the basketball and all the baseball on. Live music on the weekends. The best pizza in Kansas City and fun. Kelly's has the best rooftop patio in town and is voted one of the best places in Kansas City to check out the view, if you know what I mean. And maybe make a new friend. Make the best choice for your evening entertainment, Kelly's Westport Inn. Kelly's is at 500 Westport Road in Kansas City, Missouri. Kelly's Westport Inn.
You have been listening to a Royals Podcast Network presentation.